So tonight I want to talk on what may be the most important topic I could possibly speak on. What do you think it is?
Karma.
Okay. Karma, death,
fear,
forgiveness. I already talked on that. Huh?
Kindness.
What?
Judgment.
Enlightenment.
Practice,
love,
happiness,
money,
passion,
fear. Fear got two votes. Well, some of what I will talk about is related to those topics, but not directly will I speak on any of those topics. But I'm still going to talk about the most important topic for our practice. And that topic is how to sustain and deepen our practice in our daily lives. How to find ways that our daily lives are deep learning experiences in terms of our practice. And this is especially relevant for me coming just a little over a week ago from about 1 month on retreat. It's quite wonderful. And I'm actually, in talking about daily life issues, I want to weave in a few themes that were important to me from that month on retreat. But in a way, retreats are wonderful, and they can be times of great insight, or when we have greater clarity in our mind or on particular aspects of our lives. But ultimately, for almost all of us, almost all of our lives is outside of retreat, and it's actually outside of formal practice for most of us. And so somehow, this is where we lead our lives. This is where we develop those qualities that were mentioned, love or forgiveness or working skillfully with fear, judgments, and so forth. And so having a sense of how to be skillful and more skillful with our daily life practice, to me, is really at the center, and it's something I've been quite interested in as I've finished month retreats. I usually do one or two of those a year, and I've had a special interest in trying to see how can I approach more the level of depth of retreats in the flow of daily life. And I imagine it's something which many or most of us have reflected on, that you know, especially if you've done retreats, how can my daily life have that, some of that quality of depth? How many have had such questions, such reflections? You know, probably many of us who've done retreats have had that. And yet there are great challenges for our daily lives. You know, 2,600 years ago, when the Buddha was speaking, he actually somewhat dismissed the lay life as a site for awakening. He said the lay life is dusty, too many responsibilities. You know, other people have not always had that understanding. You know, and there have been movements within the history of Buddhism and other traditions, as you know, where a regular daily life has been seen to be a possible site of awakening. You know, particularly Mahayana Buddhism coming around the time of Jesus, a little bit before, stressed that quite a bit. And some of the texts, you have people who are lay people who have very deep levels of awakening. And actually, they're polemical dimensions to some of those texts. You know, some of you may know there's a text on Vimalakirti. And Vimalakirti is a layperson who in the text is shown to dance Dharma circles around monks and show them up as not being as wise and being stuck on their monkness and so forth. And so, but nonetheless, it's been a challenge. And I remember being in Thailand after I had spent about 2 weeks going to meetings with other people interested in connecting meditation and service and social change work, meeting I think a monk who had was the Western monk with the most years as a Thai monk, a man named Achan Panawada, who died I think in 2005. I met him in the 90s. And he said, you know, helping other people is all fine and good, but we're here to uproot the defilements in our own being. And we don't think you can really do that so well out there in the world. Right? You don't have the focus and the support to really do that so well, he said. And I took that as a kind of a challenge. And I think for many of us, we have actually quite deep spiritual aspirations. And somehow we are trying to find a way to manifest those in the context of jobs and family and work and social change and dealing with climate issues and everything, right? What Zorba the Greek called the whole catastrophe. Right? Somehow many of us are called to that. Otherwise, we might become monks or nuns or try to live in a community which was somehow really focused on spiritual practice all the time. So I think we're in this kind of middle territory, many of us, and it's not easy. It's hard. In many ways, we go what the Buddha called against the stream. You know, he was talking about how in our practice we have to deal with all of this conditioning. You know, we have all of this conditioning, social conditioning, psychological conditioning, or conditioning at a psychological level, tremendous level of conditioning. This is what Stephen Batchelor said about the way that we go in our practice against the stream. The Buddha described his teaching as going against the stream. The unflinching light of mindful awareness reveals the extent to which we are tossed along in the stream of past conditioning and habit. The moment we decide to stop and look at what is going on, like a swimmer suddenly changing course to swim upstream instead of downstream, we find ourselves battered by powerful currents we had never even expected, precisely because until that moment we were largely living at their command, at the command of that stream, of our conditioning. And so it's quite challenging. And so what I want to do, and I want to do this this evening and also next week, because I'm coming here 8 times total, 4 times 2 weeks in a row. And I want to choose themes that I can give some suggestions on what to do between the meetings, right? And give some energy for particular kinds of practice. And what I'd like to do is to talk about different ways to deepen daily life practice and to invite us to consider which one or two of these may be most important for you, maybe ones that you are not already doing, and take it up for the next week. Like say, I will commit to this enhancement of my practice, and it's going to be very different for each person. So what helps you to sustain your practice and deepen it in daily life? I'll invite, just people can speak up. You don't have to raise your hand, just maybe, well, I'll call upon people, yeah, so it's not totally chaotic. But
When I started a new job a couple months ago, actually about 6 months ago, and I talked to Philip about it, and one of the things he advised me to do was take my practice into my work.
Take your practice into your work.
And, yeah.
Yeah.
And I really tried to, when I got anxious at work or stressed, is to try to remember my practice and what the advice had been in different Dharma talks. And it really helped. I mean, it really helped me to get out of, you know, to get out of the situation where I was stressed and see it as what I could learn in that moment.
Right. Good. Well, let me. Great. That was great. Let me hear from a few others, and if you could just two or three words. Okay, so we can hear from a few people, please.
I'm escorted into trusting myself more deeply.
Trusting myself more deeply.
Inside, but also.
Okay.
In my lower.
Great. In the back.
Remember to stop hurrying,
right, please.
Noticing happiness.
Yeah.
Sit with the sunset.
Sit with the sunset, please.
Periodic times of day when I'm mindful, I make the effort to be mindful.
Yeah. Periodic times during the day to be mindful, please.
I have images or sayings around my house so that when I see them, I know to stop.
Mm-hmm. So images around the house that help with stopping. Maybe one or two more, please.
Listen to Dharma talks.
Listen to Dharma talks.
Coming here on Sunday night.
Coming here on Sunday night, right?
Dharma buddies.
Dharma buddies, okay.
Yeah,
okay, maybe last one.
Remembering what I'm grateful for.
Yeah, remembering what you're grateful for, gratitude practice. So I'm going to talk about three levels or phases of daily life practice. I'll talk about the first as foundational. The second is intermediate, and the third is more advanced. And I think between these three, it's a little bit arbitrary what fits in each category. But I'm going to talk about three of these and weave some of them into some of my reflections on being on retreat, because things came up. So at the foundational level, and I'll see, maybe I won't do the advanced till next week. Keep people something to look forward to. The advanced teachings. If we weren't doing Donna, we could ask more money, right? whether that would be wise and compassionate, I don't know. Okay, so we have a foundational level of practice. And this, again, for some of us, going more to the foundational level is exactly what is important. So a foundational level could be said to have encompass a few aspects of practice. One might be having a daily practice. And so for some of us, the next step for this next week might be, I'm really going to do it every day. Now I do it 3 days a week. I really want to have a formal practice every day. For some of us, that is very significant. For some of us, it's on and off, and I really want to keep it strong for a month, right? And really keep it that way. You know, it can take different forms. It could be really making sure I at least have some practice every day, even if it's 5 minutes. That can make a difference. Another aspect of that's foundational is really having more clarity about why we practice. It could be related to readings, listening to Dharma talks. We would say this is emphasizing the wisdom aspect. Why do I practice? What am I really doing here? What's important for me? A third aspect could be really grounding further in being ethical and bringing the ethical dimension into our daily lives more. So this would be working, and then this could actually could have a very foundational level, but could also would have its more intermediate and advanced level. So it could be working with non-harming, not taking that which is not given, with wisdom and clarity and care around three areas. These are the traditional precepts. Three areas which we often get in trouble with. That is sexuality, speech, and substances which shift consciousness. So for some of us, working more with the ethical precepts calls out to us. And again, speech practice is a very large area and can really call us, but it could also be non-harming. We can look more deeply. What does non-harming mean? You know, and when we take a social perspective, this actually, I think, can take us into deeper territory. You know, if I have a commitment to non-harming and I'm a citizen, what do I do with a country that kills in my name? You know, many have taken that as something to look at, ethically. Or we could go, when we look at the social, when we connect the social dimension to it, there's a lot of directions we could go. A fourth area that's, again, very basic is being part of a group, being part of a community, finding support in that way. Very, very crucial. Very, very basic. And it might be that we're called to go to more than one group a week, let's say. For some of us, it might be a commitment to, I really want to go to one group a week and really commit to that. You know, I know at different periods of my life, when I was first starting out practicing, I lived in Boston, and I went to three or four groups a week. You know, it really supported me a lot to go into a place where people shared my values and where my practice was supported. A fifth area that I'm listing as foundational might be to start doing longer periods of practice if you haven't already done that. It might be to start doing day-longs or consider one's first retreat or to do another retreat. You know, these are all aspects of what I'm calling a foundational level. At a more intermediate level, other types of support and practice come into play. At an intermediate level, we may really have a sense of a variety of practices. We may see how we have a kind of cross-training or a way that we practice in, you know, with multiple dimensions. We may practice mindfulness. We may practice loving kindness. We may develop work with the insights, connect with wisdom. We may also start having a sense of, are there aspects of my life that need attention from a psychological perspective? You know, some of that might be connected, for example, with the work that I often teach on judgments. We may want to work in that direction. And we may also start to bring in, and this was what you were bringing up, we start to bring in all of this more and more into the different parts of our daily life, into our relationships, into our work. And so for some of us, it might be to say, I really want to bring my practice into my work situation. Huge, right? If we spend whatever, 30, 40, 50 hours at work, where's our practice? Right? So it might be, for some of us, it might be to bring it there. It might be to bring it into family situations. It might be to bring it into relations with a partner, with different family members, and to do that together. What does that look like? Related to bringing our practice into those situations is more and more starting to take our challenges and difficulties as opportunities for practice. This is a huge turning point in our practice when we actually become interested in our difficulties. Rather than taking them simply as problems or curses, we say, ah, another opportunity for learning. Or in the Tibetan tradition, there's a very wonderful phrase, turn all obstacles into the path of practice. Or there's another great line, let me see if I have this, also from the Tibetan tradition, where it says, when this is a Tibetan saying, when the sun shines and the belly is full, I look like a Dharma practitioner. But when faced with trouble, my faults are exposed. Right? When the sun shines and the body is full, I look like a Dharma practitioner. But when faced with trouble, my faults are exposed. Right? And so to take difficulties as a starting point for practice is radical. You know, to become interested in suffering. This maybe is also shades into advanced, right? This is intermediate / advanced, but it's really something to take difficulties as starting points for practice. What can I learn? Related to that is a maturing where we have the framing of our lives as learning be there more and more. Everything is learning, and it's almost as if the purpose of human life is learning. It's a beautiful frame, and I reflect on this quite a bit after a month on retreat, because a retreat frames everything as there for the sake of learning. Everything is there, whatever happens, you know. You know, you don't sleep well, one's sleepy, particularly we look to the challenging aspects. But everything is there for the sake of learning. It's not for the sake of being calm, having pleasant experiences, and so forth. Calm is valuable, and pleasant experiences can be important, particularly when there are difficulties. But everything is for the sake of learning. You know, or another way of saying it, the Buddha once said, I don't teach for the sake of calm. I'm paraphrasing. I don't teach for the sake even of ethics. I teach for the release of the heart. I teach for liberation. Right? And we can connect that. Can everything be movement towards learning for freedom? And related to that is a sense that often, as in this intermediate level, one's priorities change. And if part of daily life practice is really looking at my priorities. Again, something very, very strong on retreat. You know, I find when I go on retreat, it's like a checking out of where my life is in alignment or not in alignment. You know, and particularly, you know, I and probably most of us who go on retreat say, my God, we are so busy. It is such a joy to be away from email for a month. Be away from newspapers. I'm not saying those, of course those are valuable in their own way, but I had a very clear sense, I am too busy. What can I cut back on? And it's not so much the busyness in itself, but with busyness, we often lose a sense of what's important. We lose a sense of priorities. Now we can try to find that sense of priorities in other ways, but that's something that happens, I think, in this intermediate level. We say, what's really important for me? Do I need to drop something? Again, we can do this through reflection. You know, in retreats, it comes more intuitively. You know, like, oh my God, you know, that, or I'm doing too much of that, or boy, I need to have more quiet in my life. Or it could be otherwise. I need to be more engaged. I need to share my practice more with the world. It doesn't just go in the direction of quiet, necessarily. Or it could be, you know, it's time for me really to manifest this in the world. It's time to manifest my insight or my care or my power and so forth. Part of that may be connected with having a clearer sense of impermanence and death. You know, one interesting insight on a month-long retreat is related to impermanence and death. You know, it's interesting. You know, 4 weeks on retreat at first seems like a long time. And at first, at the beginning of the retreat, I'm not thinking about time. I'm just in the middle of it. And then towards the middle or end of it, I realize, there's a very finite number of days in the retreat that are left. And it wasn't hard to think, our lives are like that, right? there's a finite number of days. And there's that phrase from the Psalms. Do you know that line where it says, number our days? Teach us to number our days that we may gain a heart of wisdom. Psalm 90:12, if you want to look that up. Another translation says, show me, Lord, my life's end and the number of my days. Let me know how fleeting life is. Right? And reflections on impermanence and death may be a way to deepen our practice because it gives us a sense of priority. So a 5 or 10 minute reflection on a given day can do that, can really help to deepen our practice, to have that help us with a sense of priorities. We may, at this intermediate or the advanced level, also try to have our environment be supportive. Many times after retreats, I have been interested in home beautification. I call it sometimes interior decoration, which meditation is interior decoration as well. And this retreat was no different. You know, one morning on retreat at 2 a.m., I woke up, sat up straight in bed, and said, there is too much clutter in my home. Took notes for the next hour and then went back to sleep. You know, and I've acted on it. You know, and it's something that for some of us is important. We may want our environment, where we work or where we, our homes, to actually reflect our deeper values more. That's been true for me and an important area to act on. We may want to have a sense of internal supports as well, what I could call internal supports. You know, and I think it's very helpful to ask, what supports my practice externally? What helps it internally? Internally, I'm talking about more would be communities, group. Well, maybe that would be more external. Internal would be more the practices. What practices do I do? What do I do internally? Externally would be more the environment. It might be, do I go to groups? It could be, do I work with a Dharma buddy? Sometimes at an intermediate level, we say, I want to have regular contact with a teacher. Can be tremendous for quickening practice because you have to answer to someone regularly, right? I found when I started to do that first probably almost 25 years ago. I worked with Anna Douglas for a period of time. And, you know, at other times I've worked with teachers and I found it really quickened things. It really helped me. It helped my practice a lot in different ways. And I hear that. I work myself with people and I hear that that happens. Or it might be to just form a group, two friends, who meet and talk about practice once a week, or send emails to each other. Different friends send emails about their practice. You know, we're various kinds of support. These days with cell phones, there are all sorts of apps for practice. People can be of networks of people, and they know when someone else is meditating. You know? These things seem to help, potentially helpful. So internal and external support. So I'll just close with a few things about more advanced level. I'll do some of that. I think maybe next time I'll say more about the advanced level and also go into more depth on some of the most central aspects of daily life practice, or maybe the ones that are, maybe I'll ask you as we talk together about what you'd like to hear more about, you know, and go into that. So I think at a more advanced level, there can be a further deepening of awareness of the body. Again, this could be really at all levels, because I know for me, beginning my practice, having awareness of my body was very, very central, because I wasn't really aware of my body. Even though I was physical, took hikes, was actually a competitive swimmer, but I wasn't aware of my body. You can do a lot of things and not be aware of your body. Or you know that line from one of the James Joyce short stories, Mr. Duffy lived a short distance from his body. Remember that one? Right? And we are, many of us, disconnected from our bodies. So actually, I find that being deeply embodied is a very fundamental way to deepen in daily life. You know, and I think I might say more about that next time. I have a bunch of stories about that. Another more advanced practice would be to really take our speech and communication as a spiritual practice and learn how to do that. That's what we teach in these retreats and classes. And it can really, once we do that, suddenly our talking becomes practice. And those of us who complain about, oh my God, it's such a struggle to have 20 or 30 minutes of practice. Guess what? Some of us who complain about only 20 or 30 minutes of formal practice may be talking 5 or 10 hours a day. And when one can turn that into practice, where we're conscious, and it can actually be, when it's at a high level, just as rigorous a practice as sitting on a cushion. That starts to, you can see how that starts to change things, right? When that happens. Another practice, again, may or may not be advanced, is starting to have more times for practice in one's life. I've been doing a Sabbath practice for most of the last 25 or 30 years, one day a week where I mostly practice. For some people, it's half a day. Right? You do 3 or 4 hours of practice once a week regularly. That will change things. It becomes the pivot of the week, which is the meaning of Sabbath, both East and West. You know? You do one day a week, which is different from the other days. And you have more practice, you know. And so I do mine on Wednesdays, which is, I don't know if anyone else has ever done Sabbaths on Wednesdays, but that's when I do them, because I often teach on Wednesdays at Spirit Rock, and I teach in the morning, and then I have, usually my mom comes, we have lunch, and then I have practice the rest of the day. I stay till 9 or 9:30. And stay at Spirit Rock and practice, you know. Sometimes on my own, sometimes I sit in the staff area for retreats. And so another, I'll mention just one or two more things. Another thing is what I think was mentioned by one person, I forget who that was, who mentioned finding short, was it, I think at the back, finding short practice periods? That's something I have, The finding short practice periods, this is, I have found this to be magical, to find, and usually something that's regular, find a few times during the day where you can have little 5 or 6, 4 or 5 or 6 or 8 or 10 minute breaks, where you do a kind of practice. And I have found that it has to be somewhat ritualized. So it's something that one does more or less every day. So, for example, I often, if I am, for a meal, eating on my own, I do metta for the first 5 or 10 or more minutes of the meal. And I do that all the time. So I might have 1 or 2 practice sessions there. I also have like knee exercises, which I do sitting down where I put pressure on my knee and then I put ice on my knee. I'm supposed to do that 3 times a day. It takes 8 minutes. I make it 3 8-minute practice sessions, right? Some people might take a walk after lunch. I find it needs to be done generally, somewhat ritualistically, so you can't negotiate with yourself. And find, you know, so for next week, you might say, I might find 2 or 3 ways to do this, something like that. I think there's some others, but maybe I'll mention some others next time, okay? And because I want to have time for discussion, I'll just end with a quotation. This is from a Tibetan teacher about daily life practice. I'll do a few things then. I'll end with a quotation. But I wanted to invite you before we go into discussion, just to reflect right now on your own. And if you feel called to deepen practice by doing one or two things differently than you've been doing, or add something, or make a commitment to daily practice. Just reflect on your own. What would you do? What do you feel called to do for the, just for the next week? It's only a one-week commitment for now. And just do this for yourself. Okay, I'll close with a reading from a Tibetan teacher named Kenchen Trangyu Rinpoche. It's in a book called Crystal Clear. He says, at the beginning, there is a distinct difference between the state of meditation and post-meditation, what he calls post-meditation, which means all the time we're not doing formal meditation. But now we need to merge these two states into one so that our practice becomes more and more continuous. This mingling is considered to be of utmost importance. When your practice becomes grounded in ideal circumstances, you must also learn to sustain it no matter where you are or no matter what happens. So to ensure that you're not only practicing when things are going well, we need instructions on mingling meditation and post-meditation. Sometimes stay in a quiet place. Sometimes surround yourself with noise. Sometimes surround yourself with sense pleasures. Sometimes go to places that provoke strong emotions, such as anger, desire, jealousy, and so forth. So you say, actually, deliberately challenge yourself, right? Deliberately find, maybe that's advanced. Okay. Sometimes go where you feel very insecure or threatened. In all these situations, check whether or not you are capable of sustaining your practice. So maybe that's advanced. So the basic idea is we ground in a more protected place, our quiet place, and then we gradually bring the practice out into all the circumstances of our lives. So thank you for your attention. And we have some time. I'm going to move to the metta in about 10 minutes, but we have some time for discussion. So, or questions, please, Vita.
For a second, when you say during short periods during the day,
yeah,
on a ritual basis, so it's the same time, do you do metta all at each one of those times? Do you do a different practice at each time?
When I'm having meals on my own, I always do metta.
Yeah. And then when you're taking care of your knee?
Taking care of my knee, I actually do, I typically do some practices where I work with intentions, which is a theme I had on my list, but I didn't bring up this time, where I actually remind myself of my deeper intentions 4 times a day for about 2 or 3 minutes. I have a whole set of phrases which I repeat to myself, and I do that typically at the beginning, and then I just go into my regular meditation. Yeah.
Could you share those intentions with us next time?
I could, yeah. I'll write that down. I'll talk about intentions next time. It's one of the themes I didn't talk about. It's very important. I'll just say in passing that intentions are a really crucial way to bring the practice into daily life. It could be as simple as saying, I'm going into a meeting, I will try to practice wise speech and be with yourself with that for 10 seconds. Or sometimes what I do to help support those intentions, I'm at a meeting, I have a sheet and paper in front of me, and I write down the guidelines for wise speech right in front of me. You know, so I'm looking at them during the meeting. Right? You know, one person for difficult discussions with a teenage daughter wrote down the guidelines for wise speech in her hand, had them in front of her as she was talking to her daughter. Right? So I think this is part of what intention means. But intention, really, really crucial. It's a way of coming back, and it doesn't mean that everything works like we want it to work, but it helps. Right?
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. Please, yeah.
Well, we had someone speak, the woman from Oakland recently, and she was talking about metta, and I've been on metta retreats, but not for a while. But I decided that for my own practice, that I would practice metta, where I would practice metta for myself for a week, and then I would practice metta for a benefactor and do the sequence.
Yeah.
So now it's been 1 week, but I don't really want to go off of just myself. I'm really benefiting myself. So what do you, have a suggestion?
Yeah, so a question about doing a sequence of practice over several weeks, which is a great way to, by the way, to deepen daily life practice. Another way, take a sequence where you maybe say, I'm going to work with metta practice for this amount of time, and maybe there is a sequence where you start with self and you go through the different categories or different types of being. I would say that either way, either going through the sequence or just staying with yourself could be beneficial. And in daily life, I think what is most helpful is to have the metta flowing so it feels rich and alive. And for some people, there may just be a sense, this is where I really, the metta's calling, maybe towards self. So I would probably tend to go with where you feel the energy. There could be reasons for doing the sequence as well. But you could just say, okay, well, I'll do the sequence another time. And that's fine. You know, when I do metta in those short periods, I don't go through the whole sequence. I do metta especially for people I care about a lot, which tends to produce a lot of the energy of metta, and I don't go through the whole sequence. So in daily life, our basic guideline for metta is go where the juice is. Yeah. And again, there can be reasons to go through the sequence or work with a difficult person or whatever, I would generally follow your intuition, I would say. Yeah, thank you. Please, yeah.
Maybe I need to take a retreat on wise speech. I feel like when I really can be very aware and conscious of my speech,
yeah,
I speak much less.
You speak?
Much less.
Much less.
Because if it isn't true and it isn't beneficial, then I stop right there.
Yeah.
And it has to be beneficial the way I interpret it to all parties.
Mm-hmm.
So some would say that, you know, sometimes communication, it oils the social.
Yeah.
And I don't know, I guess I'm not.
So it's quite really, if I can say, it's a question of wise speech as a major way to deepen practice, and finding that when you follow the guidelines for wise speech, you know, which I, in my own framing of it, I identify the guidelines from the tradition as pointing to being truthful, being helpful, coming out of a good heart, and having good timing and appropriateness of speech and so forth. And finding that a lot of your speaking falls away when you follow those guidelines. I think that many people have that experience. It's really partly what wise speech practice is about, is really saying, what's the motivation for my speaking? Do I have habits of just distracted speech, right? Or speech which is somewhat mindless? Now, I think that oiling the social, oiling social connections has its value, can be helpful in certain ways. I mean, it can be helpful to connect with someone by speaking about whatever, the sports or, you know, something, all sorts of things, right? That can be, and so One of the things, when we do the retreat on speech practice, we go a lot beyond those guidelines. And some of that's helpful. So, for example, to have a core motivation to connect with another, that may, there may be all sorts of speech that are beneficial in one sense, but that you might not talk about with some people, right? So I might try to see what subject matter helps me connect with this person. Well, that can be helpful speech, mm-hmm. right? But it might not look quote unquote spiritual, right? You know, and so forth. So yeah, it's a great area. I think that's another area I'll speak more on next time, because it's and we, you know, when we do the retreat, we actually give a lot of attention to mindfulness of the body. Because one of the ways that I've been, I think, innovating with speech practice, and I think I've taught it here once or twice, is to find ways to have both inner and outer awareness at the same time. That's a major way to deepen our practice, and it's not easy, and grounding in the body is a major way to make that possible. So like right now, can you stay in your body, have some degree of inner presence, even if it's 25%, and also listen to me? Just at least stay in the body a little bit, right? Mm-hmm. And so that becomes a major way to have practice come in. So please, yeah.
Sometimes I find myself in conversations or speech where it feels like, well, if I told, quote unquote, the whole truth,
yeah,
it would not be beneficial.
Yeah.
But not saying anything that isn't true, but not saying everything that could be said.
Yeah.
I don't know if that makes any sense.
It does, yeah.
And so, but it always feels uneasy because it's like I don't feel like I'm telling the entire truth as I see it at that moment. And so I ask myself, well, what am I getting out of not telling the whole truth? Is
right.
it really, you know, not beneficial to the other person? Or is it, I just don't want to face the music of what the whole truth might
right.
be?
Right.
And I think I'm stuck in those binds.
Well, it's a great question. And I hear the spirit of inquiry. It's really asking, what about this guideline of speaking truthfully? Does that mean, as in a court of law, that we tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help me God? No. If we, you know, it'd be interesting in the court of law to say, we tell the whole truth, but have it be beneficial, come from your heart. And be appropriate, right? So, the wonderful thing about these teachings on wise speech is actually pretty sophisticated. It's saying that we can recognize that telling the whole truth, as we can see this very easily in the interpersonal context, is not necessarily beneficial. It can actually be a weapon, right? Clearly, we know that. And so balancing the four factors, very crucial. And then having that spirit of inquiry that I was hearing from you, where you say, okay, I'm not speaking the whole truth. What's my motivation here? Is it because I don't think it's helpful? Or is it because I'm wanting to hold back? Do I have strategic motives? Or what's going on, right? And that is great. That the speech practice, in fact, I think a lot of daily life practice is really supported by this spirit of inquiry. It's another. Maybe I could bring that in. Having a spirit of asking questions: what's going on? What's my motivation? What's happening for me? I think I'll bring that in also next time. It's a great area. Okay, we're at time because I want to honor the reading of the meta cards. And what?
No meta cards.
Oh, yeah, there is.
Okay.
What?
Yeah.
Oh. Do I have, can I have three more minutes? Do we have time for that? So we fully respect all the cards? Would that work?
Just one card.
Just one card. So I think I do have time then. I just wanted to ask, or maybe let's do the card, and then I had one more thing to close. Okay? Let's do that. Okay.
for Brenda, who's having surgery this week.
Thank you. Good. So I guess we have more time than usual. So we probably can take. I want to end with a little practice together, but we have time if probably for one or two more questions, if there are some, or observations, please. Yeah.
I was with my son today, and that of course brings up those habitual, reactions to things. And I was working with it, but then I felt afterwards judgmental of myself.
Yeah.
Being snarky about his ex-wife, and wondering if, just catching myself, but also, what do you do with all of that?
Yeah. So what to do about noticing, being judgmental towards a family member, it could be a coworker or a friend and whatever. And so, there's a whole, that opens up to a whole other area that I didn't mention explicitly. The starting point, though, is mindfulness. It's that you notice that this is the way my mind's working. It's, the Buddha called it mindfulness of snarkiness. Right, the Pali term. I won't make one up. And so mindfulness is a starting point. And that is great. The fact that you noticed it makes everything possible. And you could go in a few different directions. So, for example, when I teach on judgments, there are whole sets of practices that one can do. The starting practice is, would be to just make a commitment to look at that, notice when that appears in other settings. So the first thing is just to be mindful. I think of mindfulness in three ways. First is to be mindful, just notice it. The second would be when it lasts for a while, not just to label it, but to feel what it's like in the body, if it stays for a while. Really study it in the present moment without trying to make anything happen, but just actually studying it. You might find doing that, for example, that there might be something beneath the judgment. Generally, judgments are driven by other emotions or other patterns, other habit energy. So actually just studying it in the present moment can be very valuable. And another technique you can sometimes do is at the end of the day, you can relive the experience, bring it to mind, and study it in the present moment 6 hours later. And see what it's like, just to see what's there. Again, not trying to make anything happen, but just to say, what was that about? And look at it. You can also start to see over time whether they're patterns. If judgments are really a major force in your life, if you're noticing that they're a lot, it's very good to do a heart practice. And you can also do forgiveness practices, such as we did last time I was here, where you actually offer forgiveness to the other person and to yourself. I think of that as kind of cleaning up the mess practice. I do it. I'm driving, I cut off a driver, or a driver cuts off me. Time for a little forgiveness practice. Again, ways to bring this into daily life. You're feeling bad about something, you did something that wasn't skillful. Forgiveness practice, very, very helpful on the spot, right there. And it actually, and it can just, again, if you do it a lot, you can do it in 3 minutes, 4 minutes or something, and it actually feels like a kind of internal cleansing is going on. And then there are further practices, which we do a lot in the judgment work, where you can actually do deeper inquiry into what's there. Because generally, like I say, a lot of our judgmental energy is actually comes from something beneath the surface. And we can look into that in psychological work, and so forth. You know, and there's a lot typically that's beneath the surface that we can look at in using psychological means, using meditative means, sometimes interpersonally if we have a good relationship and can do it that way, and so forth. So that's a starting point. Yeah, thank you. Okay, maybe I'll be brief. Last two, and then we'll finish. Okay, please.
I was wondering if you have ideas about how to work with impatience.
How to work with impatience. Well, it takes a certain amount of patience to work with impatience. It's a great one. Very similar guidance as to your name.
Jerry.
I was giving Jerry. Starting point is just noticing it. You can name it. I'm feeling impatient. In the moment, see if you can actually feel what's there. One technique, which I didn't name, which we use a lot in judgments, is a technique where we go from the lived experience and bring the attention into the body. Often if we access the body, particularly locate your awareness around the area of the heart. I think Philip sometimes works with a technique like this that he calls dropped attention. I call it the dropping down practice, where we go from the verbal level, more of the mental level, into the body, and often we can access what's driving a particular thought or emotion. Anything repetitive, it's a really great technique to use. So you can actually, you're feeling impatient, go into your body, what's there? And you can use some of the other techniques I was mentioning. Notice when it happens, some inquiry. Partly just to hang out with it. Often if we just hang out with it, what's there discloses itself. It's quite helpful. But the starting point is just to notice it and be with it, and that goes a long way. Okay, maybe last one now.
I was just going to mention there was a talk on Dharma Seed by Tara Brock about using stress in daily life. I don't know if you heard it. It's really fantastic.
No.
And it talks about how you have that moment when the stress is triggered, and
yeah,
you can either feed it and be aversive to it,
yeah,
or you can use it as a way to become empowered or... It's a great talk, and it's really about exactly what you're saying, is bringing the practice into your daily life.
Right, so that would be using moments of stress, noticing it with mindfulness, and then maybe inquiring into it, seeing what's there, and using a moment of stress, where you might say a moment of difficulty, as a starting point for practice, rather than as a starting point for frustration or tying oneself in knots. Yeah. I'll bring in something like that as well next time. Great. So to close, I wanted to hear, I'd like you to reflect again, what is your intention, those of you who feel drawn, to focus for the next week on one or two things that you might do that would sustain or deepen your practice. It can fall in any of those categories, what I was calling the foundational or intermediate or advanced. How many of you do feel drawn to do that for the next week? Okay. And so just reflect on what that is. And see if you can, again, I'll ask for if you can formulate it maybe just in a short phrase, two or three, four words, so we can hear from a few people to close. Yeah, please. Just speak up loudly so everyone can hear you.
Morning sit before morning email.
Morning sitting before morning email. Please.
And short practice at meal time.
Short practice at
meal time.
At meal time. Yeah. Please. Others, you'd like to share? By the way, publicly speaking an intention strengthens the intention considerably. Because you have witnesses, and they may ask you, how was that intention? So if you want to strengthen your intention, speak up, please.
I've been doing my meditation on the bus, so I'm going to do it at home a little bit more. I'm still on the bus. So.
More home meditation, continued bus meditation. Please.
Try to remember what my intention is to begin with. I can start out with an intention, but by the middle of the day,
yeah,
it's forgot.
Yes, to remember what the intention is during the course of the day. Please, in the back.
Practice sunrise and sunset.
Practice at sunrise and sunset. Beautiful. Please.
Work with an obstacle.
Yeah, so make that commitment on a daily basis. If there's an obstacle that arises, I'll work with it, right?
And we have to, huh?
Yeah. Yeah. Please.
One period of trying to pay attention to what during the day and a focus on the speech.
Yeah. Further period of practice. Yeah. Could be short. And then focus on speech. Beautiful.
Remember, I have a body.
What?
Remember, I have a body.
Remember, I have a body. Great, please.
Making an effort to be in the present moment, especially against challenging times when I tend to forget to remember myself.
Remembering to be in the present moment, especially in difficult or stressful situations.
Right.
Beautiful. One or two more to finish? Anyone else? Okay.
Take a break every hour from the computer and do walking meditation.
Wow, take a break every hour from the computer and do walking meditation. Thank you. Okay, anyone want to do the last one? Please.
I'll do three short meditations during the day.
Three short meditations during the day. I feel very good hearing everyone. And may our intentions result in the deepening of our practice for our own benefit and for the benefit of others. And let's just close with a few moments of metta, which really helps us to remember that we practice both for ourselves and for others. Feeling that quality of caring in the heart for ourselves. And bringing to mind one or two of those most close to us and feeling those beings with us, feeling our care. And then bringing the kind heart out into the space of the hall here. Coming out from the heart in front and back, left and right, above and below, filling the space with the energy of caring for all of us here. And then finally going beyond the boundaries of this hall, out into the world, bringing that kind heart, having a sense of it radiating out in space in all directions without limit. In front and back, left and right, above and below. Back to our being present in our bodies and beginning the next week. And see you next Sunday.